How do you balance character development versus world building versus moving the plot forward? Well, hang on, we'll talk about it. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Now, I just made a split-second decision. I can't talk today. So right now, it is June 26th as I record this, June 26th, 2024. And just as I told you right before the intro music, today we're talking about how to balance world building with character development and moving the plot forward. And this is an interview that I recorded with author Michael Buxbaum on May 13th of this year. Now, before we get into it, I have my little announcement section. That's what this is right now. I was going to also talk about like how to make a buck as an author, but I think there's enough there that I'll make it a bonus episode this coming Monday. So as you're listening, if you're a subscriber and you listen the day it comes out, then today is for you, it's June 27th. So wait for Monday, which will be July 1st, I believe. And then we'll talk about some things I've had going on recently about trying to run some promos, and there was also a giveaway, and yeah. So for now, I'll just tell you some basic updates. If I look a little tired, it's because I am. I'm always tired, right? It's true. But I've been continuing to work on emptying my old house. We are getting ready to sell it, and so I've been moving a lot of furniture from the old house to the shed here at our house where we live. And a new development is that we have a new roof in the works for the old house. We were able to get somebody to come and take a look at it and work with our homeowner's insurance, and they're going to cover the cost of a new roof. They're obviously, we have a deductible that we owe to the roofers that are going to be replacing the roof. But I'm very relieved because that's going to help it sell, and we're not having to pay for a new roof out of pocket, which is expensive and difficult. You know, it's one of those things like maybe you go ahead and put the house on the market and the buyer asks for a credit, and so then when they buy the house, you know, they get the loan that pays for the house, but a lot of lenders don't like to lend on a house that needs a new roof, and so they need to see that receipt at closing. That actually happened with our current house. When we bought the house, the home inspector said the roof is old, and the VA doesn't want to cover, back that up, you know. So the seller was required to provide a receipt at closing that showed that a roofer was paid. And so then they came and actually replaced the roof after we moved in. But for our old house, we are able to do it the other way around because the insurance is they've already approved it. So that's a huge weight off of our shoulders, I apologize for trying to talk too fast and I slur it. I'm looking at my notes, which is overhead. Yeah. So, that's kind of what's going on over here. I'm trying to get this house, out of our hands, so we can stop worrying about it, and I can focus a lot more on writing my books. Speaking of which, the work continues on Nightshade Unicorn Book 2, which is Guardian, is the title that I'm planning on. You're right. So I'm still shooting to release it on August 28th. To be honest, I am nervous about being able to make it by that deadline. And I've said so before, it's still true. but I also feel optimistic about it because I've been prepping things, so I hopefully will be able to rip through the rest of it rather quickly. The scenes that I haven't written, I'm working to have them outlined so I don't hit a wall. Like, what do I need to write next? You know. Instead, I can go for a long walk. And I actually, if you listen to my interview with Todd Fonestock earlier this year, he goes on like a 15-mile walk every day. And I've been beginning to think that that might be how I do. But I need to get this house off my shoulders so I can dedicate the time to have to do the outlining and be able to crank it out, you know. So I do anticipate once this house is off our shoulders and we get some other things ironed out personal-wise, like in our lives, things that have been eating up our time, then I'll be able to produce books more quickly. And I will branch out to other series. I will probably branch out to other genres or sub-genres of fantasy at the very least. And I'm looking forward to having time to, I've been thinking of some new, videos, you know, for Instagram, for TikTok, for, YouTube shorts to, I'm not going to talk about that right now. You'll see it when it happens. Hopefully by the end of the summer, I'll have some of those, but, for now, it's the big ask is to write this book. And it's time. Like, the calendar is nipping at my heels, and so is the cover artist. So I mentioned previously that we've got her lined up. This is Rebecca at Vivid Covers, and she did the cover for Forerunner for book one, and I think it looks great. And I think So now the problem is that since I don't have the rest of book two properly outlined yet, I'm so close. I don't have a full vision of the book, and she is waiting for me to get back to her. I told her I'd get back to her really soon. She sent me an email over the weekend and asking if I was ready to fill out the questionnaire that she sent me so that she can get started on the cover that I'm paying her to make. So yeah, the calendar is nipping at my heels. Something else in the works is an audiobook for book one, and you know, book two will naturally follow, but I'm, you know, one step at a time. I recently, over the past month, I guess, I swapped a couple of emails with the Michael Kramer, Kate Redding team, and they declined. They took a look at Forerunner, and they came back and they said, well, it's YA, and the main character is a teenager. Although I do point out that the teenager means different things in different worlds. Like in Wheel of Time, a year is 500 days long. Now, I haven't decided how many days are in a year, but in Nightshade Unicorn, you do know that there are 11 months. I haven't decided how long the months are. So anyway, but yeah, she is a teenager. She comes of age within her society, so she is an adult, but it's young adult, exactly what it is. And so the Michael Kramer, Kate Redding team felt that my work would be better served by younger voices. And I get that. It's 'cause there is a certain weight in their words, that their voices hold a certain weight. So I understand. And they actually recommended that I hit up their son and his, I don't know the term, co-reader, his partner, because they also have a reading team. And so they recommended their son and his partner, and I have yet to reach out to them. I got the last response from the Kramer Redding team a few days ago, and I've just been swamped, so I haven't reached out to their son yet. But before I do that, I have not heard them read, so I need to I need to look them up in Audible and listen to some samples and see what I feel about their performance and their how they come across. I'm still playing with the idea of reading it myself. The problem is that if I read it myself, that's just another huge thing on my plate. And if I pay somebody else to do it, that shortens my runway, doesn't it? But it allows me to do more with the runway space that I have. So yeah, that's kind of what's going on. And I'm going to skip over my spiel about, or not spiel, but the information that I was about to share. You'll get that on Monday. I will record it momentarily, so it'll be ready for me. And I'll go ahead and let you get into the interview. And now as you listen, remember that... Michael Buxbaum writes science fiction, and he's currently working on breaking into epic fantasy as well. And you'll hear that in the interview. But if anything that he talks about sounds interesting, hit him up. His link will be in the show notes, so you can go and look up his work. And so Monday we'll have the little in-between episode with the data that I was about to share. But I made the split-second decision to push it because it's probably going to be 15 minutes. And today's episode is going to be about an hour anyway, so I didn't want it to go overly long. But look up Michael Buxbaum's work. I believe it's probably... I don't remember the URL. You'll hear it in a minute. And next week, to celebrate the 4th of July, I will have on author Anthony Doyle, who is... an Irishman living in Brazil. So I say tongue in cheek. This is the week that his interview fell in, happened to be our Independence Day. That was another good interview. So thank you for listening today. Here's today's interview, and we'll see you next time. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. Michael Buxbaum. Did I pronounce that correctly? I'm sorry, I didn't ask before we...
You got that perfectly. I usually get Buxbaum, but Buxbaum, you got that right. First time.
Okay, great. And you write science fiction. And this is maybe a weird question. It occurred to me in the car as I was coming back from dropping my daughter off at school this morning. Is this a pen name, or is that your actual given name?
So, yeah.
I don't speak German. Is your actual name? Okay. I don't speak German, but I think Buch, like Buchsbaum, that's like book tree, isn't it? Books tree.
Yep. Yeah, man, you know more German than I did. I actually only learned what my last name meant probably 7-8 years ago.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great last name for an author.
Thank you.
Books tree. Yeah, that's fascinating. I wonder how that surname originated.
I think it had to do with like cutting topiary bushes. I could be totally off on this, but I think that the book tree is the one that you can kind of shape. I'm sure somebody out there can totally correct me on it. I've done no research into my last name. I just know it's German and it does mean book tree.
Yeah. That's crazy. All right. So, tell us about your background. Like was you major in, or like, how did you get into writing?
Yeah, sure. So, I started really getting into writing at 17, because I wanted to write for video games. Actually, wasn't much of a reader. Never was, until later in life, of course. But
what kind of video games?
Oh, RPGs like Skyrim, Elder Scrolls, and then the Final Fantasy Tales of series. I watched a lot of anime, watched a lot of cartoons, watched a lot of television, and that just made me want to write stories. So I wanted to write them kind of like screenplays to plug into video games. So that's how I first started writing things. Of course, I was garbage for a very long time.
Yeah.
And so I went to school for graphic design. And so I majored in that. And I was a web developer and designer for 6 years. And I've been writing the whole time, trying to get an agent, failing miserably, you know, dozens mm-hmm. and dozens of query letters sent out, nothing gotten back. And so I was doing all that. And now the dogs are going crazy in the background. I hope you, you can't hear them too bad.
I hear them a little bit. It's fine.
Okay, yeah. I'm not sure what's going on back there. But so during this whole time, I was writing. I was failing. And then COVID came, and I got laid off my job. And at that point, I realized I kind of hate doing this. The whole web design stuff to begin with. I'm like, coding's just not that fun. Because I find that whenever I'm doing web stuff, I'm thinking about writing. And I'm thinking about book stuff. And I'm not trying to get better at web. I'm trying to get better at writing. So yeah, I got laid off. And I thought, all right, you know what? I'm just going to throw my hat into the writing thing and just do that as much as I can to get an agent. And lo and behold, I finally got an agent with Talcott Notch. Her name's Amy Collins. She's amazing. So that kind of...
Talcott Notch? Is that an agency company?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I see. Okay. Go on.
Yeah. So I got her as an agent. And then she started pitching a book. It didn't gain traction. And then she started pitching the next book I wrote, and that got a publisher within a couple months. And that's the first and only book I've gotten published so far, you know, knock on wood that I'll get something else published in the future. But, so that's kind of how it went. And all in all, it was around 14 years of writing from the first manuscript I finished, dumpster fire, but finished, to actually getting published. So long journey.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. I took a shortcut. so I didn't get an agent. I didn't query anything. I created my own imprint and published under that. And like you, I have one book out so far. It's this one you can see behind me in the video. Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner. It's just different ways of doing things. And I know a lot of people, there's still a little bit of a stigma attached to self-publishing, but, there are ups and downs. So I wish, I could offload more of the work. That's kind of the tax that I pay for saying, no, I'm getting published. I'm not even going to try to give anybody the opportunity to tell me no. I'm just going to go ahead and do all the work. That means like I had to go and hire the cover designer. I had to work to get feedback for editing. And anyway, so your book, let's plug your book.
Though I do want to say that when it comes to self-publishing, I respect it so much more than I can say, because I have no ability to market anything whatsoever. And so I didn't go the self-publishing route because I'm a coward, frankly. I'm afraid to try to do that. So I really do respect it. And like you said, it is a different route. When we talk more, I'll talk more about the traditional publishing, and it is definitely not all sunshine and rainbows, and I'll tell you that.
I'll go ahead and call myself a coward. So I didn't want to take the rejection, and part of it is just simply for the idea of not taking no for an answer. And part of it is that, I didn't want to, the gatekeepers, you know, the idea of gatekeepers. Yeah. I didn't want to go up against the gatekeepers. I didn't want to face the gatekeepers. Like, no, I'm going to take the back route and get in anyway. And that's kind of on par with the fact that right now I'm not in some corporate job somewhere. So I was active duty Marine Corps for 12 years, and then coming off of that, I was like, it's time for a shift, and we have some savings and we're doing this thing, and I hope it works. And I don't want to
I don't want to submit my resume to places for them to pass over. I don't want to go through interviews to then get not selected for a job. I don't want to play that game. So maybe that's cowardice, or maybe that's just finally holding a standard for myself. But
I'm with you on that. There is something to be said whenever they reject a book. It's almost, and you know, at the end of the day, they really are just rejecting the book. But it hurts. I can attest to that. And it's very frustrating. The whole process was a nightmare to get the agent, to get published. And I was on the verge of quitting. And again, it's not like everything's on the up and up as soon as you get an agent. So no, I understand and totally respect that. If I was more self-motivating, I would have probably tried the self-publishing route, but I'm just not good enough at it.
Well, your cover is good. Your cover designer did a good job. It's called Break the Moon, right? And
so I got it right.
What's it about?
Looks like it's backwards on the cover, but
yeah. So I'm looking back and forth between monitors, and I guess viewers obviously can't see my monitor over here. Flash that cover any chance you get.
Break the Moon, I love the cover. I am really happy with that. I really am eternally grateful to my agent Amy and Lost Boys Press, the imprint. So I really do appreciate what they've done. Like they've been amazing every step of the way. So what it's about is it's about a 16-year-old boy, young adult, Leon, who he makes these inventions and they do amazing things. Like they can teleport, they can levitate, they can go fast by burning no fuel. But they only work once, and then they never work again. They usually blow up and cause trouble. And he can't remember how he makes them. After the fact, like while he's making them, he's like, oh yeah, this is so easy. I know everything. Then afterward, it's like, I don't have any idea what I just did. So the story is kind of about him trying to figure out why that's happening. And he has some financial trouble that he has to figure out. And his inventions are blowing up every time he tries to show them off. So he can't make money that way. And so he's approached by someone who says, like, I have a friend who had the same problem you did and he's dead. So I might be able to help you. And it just all kind of spirals from there into, like secret societies and things that are happening behind the scenes in society that nobody has any idea about that are all correlated back to, Leon's gift or curse, depending on how you look at it. And he may or may not be in the middle of all of it and had never had any idea to begin. So,
okay. I guess, listeners will have to read it and find out. So you said right now you're working on a second book. Is it a sequel to this? Or is this one a standalone?
It is standalone. I'm hoping to write a sequel at some point, though. I want to throw my hat in the fantasy ring. The epic fantasy specifically. And so I've been working on that, and man, jumping from sci-fi to epic fantasy is not as easy as I'd hoped. It's been tough. And let's just say I'm still working on the manuscript, but I would like to make a sequel at some point to Break the Moon. It has a special place in my heart. It's a rewrite of the very first manuscript I ever wrote, which was that incredible dumpster fire, just an awful mess. But this is the second rewrite in 14 years, and it's like, okay, well, it ended up being the first book that got published. I feel like there's some irony there, and I don't know if it's good irony or bad, but it's there.
Well, I think this gives us a pretty good segue into our nominated topic for conversation here, because we had said, you know, we could have talked about pantsing versus plotting. I do already have an episode about that. Doesn't mean we can't revisit it. Magic systems, again, I do have another episode. But twists and so we kind of said we'd talk about like finding your way through how to write it, like how to produce it, right? So I imagine it's different between science fiction and fantasy. I say I imagine because I've written a fantasy novel. I've written some sci-fi short stories. I've never written a sci-fi novel.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, in sci-fi, you're probably basing it in this world or the future of this world or the human race. In fantasy, you're probably making up a new society. Maybe not. There is urban fantasy. There's Harry Potter and Percy Jackson. But, you know, you mentioned epic fantasy, and epics are usually just in a completely different world. So there's different world building to do. So, yeah, what have you found or what have you encountered that provides a challenge or any solutions for what works for you?
Yeah, so I think you covered some good ones, specifically the fact that the sci-fi, like the Break the Moon is near future sci-fi. So it does have that groundwork of people know how society works, people know how other people react to certain things. Whereas when you do epic fantasy, especially when you're getting into other creatures, other sentient creatures that aren't like humans, mm-hmm. Those preconceived notions of how a society works can get tossed out a window. And you have to build that from the ground up. That leads to a lot of, normally it'd be description and like world building, setting. And that can be done really, really well through characters and dialogue. A lot of times it's very tempting to info dump, and that's the absolute worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
But when you're not info dumping, you have to find other more subtle ways to bring it out. And the best way to do it is without the reader even realizing that you're dumping information mm-hmm. onto the page, because it's following the story and they think, oh, we're just following the story right now. And actually it's the writer trying to just shove society into your face, the new way that you're setting up society. And that has been a struggle, because my way of writing is very character driven stories. Now they say there's plot driven, they're character driven. And I think it can be true, but it's merged more than people think.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
when it came to epic fantasy, I was really struggling to not make it plot driven, to put the characters first and forefront, especially whenever the world is so different from ours that you can easily get lost in the little details. And that's not fun to read. Nobody would watch Lord of the Rings if they didn't care what happened to the characters. Nobody would watch Star Wars if they didn't like any of the characters. Doesn't mean they were bad settings. That's the opposite. I think Lord of the Rings has one of the greatest settings ever written. But you have to have them following that story and those characters. So you can't afford to get lost in the weeds whenever you write. And that was something.
Yeah, I think, a couple of things. You mentioned not info dumping, and I know I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I remember this one ebook in the kind of early days of Kindle Direct Publishing that I downloaded and I tried to read. It sounded terribly interesting. It was what was it? Was it fantasy or sci-fi? But it was like set in a different version of our world and back a few thousand years, I think. And so somebody was canoeing on this lake in Montana, and there were like giant beasts swimming through the clear water. And
okay.
And then like, here's all the geological history behind, and like just dump, dump, dump. And I'm like, these are cool. What's happening? Absolutely nothing is happening, because it was textbook definition of an info dump, and I couldn't make it through because I wanted to see something happening, and I didn't continue. I read something else, and to this day I still want to know what happens in that story, but I don't remember. Like I think I removed that book from my bookshelf in Kindle, and I don't know. So don't info dump. And then you mentioned plot-driven versus character-driven. And I have not joined in many discourses or conversations on what those things mean, but I see it as, me as a consumer, I think growing up, I was very drawn by settings. So like Star Trek, oh, it's in space. Cool. Lord of the Rings, there's magic. There's a dragon, in The Hobbit, and this ring turns you invisible. So these are aspects of the world that were interesting. And I don't say this in jest, but maybe I am borderline autistic, like just a little bit on the spectrum. And I didn't care as much, or at least I didn't know that I cared as much about the people, and I cared about the things, the interesting things in the world. But I have learned that if that's all there is, it gets boring. You do need people to keep it interesting, to keep it, like you said, you wouldn't care about Lord of the Rings if you didn't care what happened to the characters. And I remember watching the old cartoon, Lord of the Rings, and, you know, Frodo has this ring and turns invisible. And that's what I cared about. It's like, oh, this power to turn invisible. But then there's this troop of orcs marching by, and now you're concerned that danger is going to come upon him. So yeah, you do care about the characters, but perhaps the setting draws you in. And I kind of see that with Nightshade Unicorn. Going to go ahead and plug my series title again, where the concept originated from wanting to do something different, something interesting, like, okay, let me take something that's common and twist it. So we have a unicorn. Let's make him dark, you know, make him foreboding and somber. And then, like, why would that be? And just started building the world off of that. Now, as I go into book two, I don't know how to write a sequel. I've never done it before. And sorry, I'm talking a lot. I'll give you the mic back. In the sequel, I have to, first of all, be consistent with book one. And then don't world dump, but maybe some world drops here and there, because I hope you've already read book one. If you haven't, I'll just give you the context. But now it has to be like we've invested in these characters through book one. Now we're in book two, and we want to know what's going on with these characters. And that's how I'm trying to approach it now. So like right now I'm writing through, Delgan. So if you've read book one and you wanted to see more of Delgan, you will. I'm writing that. And I have to put myself in his head. Like, where am I? What has happened? Why does that matter to me as Delgan? What am I going to do about it? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think, and when it comes to plotting, plot versus character driven, I think there's a lot of crossover. I think very, very few stories are just strictly one or the other. And in that exact sense, though, it is. It's related to what the characters are going through. And when you write a sequel, because I've been trying to think of it a lot, just because I'm also thinking of a sequel that I haven't started writing yet, you really do. You still have to introduce new things of the world for people to get attached to. Like you said, when with Lord of the Rings, the ring was interesting. The background was interesting. The setting was very interesting. And there's nothing wrong with reading a story for that. There really isn't. I will say that a lot of documentaries are like war documentaries, because you can find the what happened interesting. Like, say, World War II, it's not, you know, following any one character, but those documentaries are still compelling. And in the same way, stories are about the characters themselves. So documentaries, I like to say, are plot driven. This is my own thought on this. This isn't like a textbook response. And they can still be interesting. When it comes to sequels, I always think where does a character go? Because you want to have that first book that was satisfying. Like, you know, the character had the beginning arc. By the end, they changed to something else. So they've had that full character arc, and they've grown. And so where does that go in the sequel? And so I always try to think, what can I show about the character that I haven't shown yet? And this mm-hmm. really, this also applies scene by scene, because every scene has a climax and falling action. And, you know, the whole book has a climax as well. But that does have to go down to the granular every single scene. Something happens. Something changes. Something is experienced by some of the characters somewhere.
Yeah.
And you just have to keep growing the character. So what is it that they haven't shown the reader yet? What have they not been put through that can help them grow to the next stage of their evolution, whether that evolution is a good thing or a bad thing? And that's,
yeah,
that can be tough whenever you write the first novel to what you think is a completion. And I think this might be why a lot of sequels kind of flounder whenever their creator didn't intend to write a sequel. When they're like, okay, mm-hmm. I wrote the standalone thing. That's where I want it to end. And then it blows up, gets big, and the studio or whatever commissions them. Okay, time to write a sequel. And then the sequel comes out terrible. And that
I saw a comic about that where there are these elves, apparently they have pointy ears. And it's like, there's a problem solved, happily ever after. And then somebody, the editor or publisher leans into the author and says, hey, it's a big hit. We need more.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth panel. Never mind. And everything is just broken and
yep.
It's all red and on fire because now we have to have more problems to solve.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say an opinion. Like if you like the new Star Wars, great. If you don't, great. Your opinion. I will say that when
what new Star Wars?
The sequel trilogy.
Sorry, I'm joking.
Oh, okay.
Star Wars? There were all six movies, right?
I was about to say, like, oh no, I'm gonna have to explain Star Wars, but no, you're good. Yeah, no, I like to think there's also six movies. That's just me, my opinion. You know? Yeah. And so I'm gonna be as kind as I can and say that they had an uphill battle when they started writing the seventh movie for the exact reason that you just explained. Everything's happily ever after, and now they still have to have something to fight. And so what do you know? The Empire's back, and they're somehow super strong again.
Sure. They did have an uphill battle writing movie 7, but then they didn't build off of it at all when they came to... Well, okay, movie 8, a little bit off of 7, but 9 is just completely non-sequitur. Like... somehow they ruined it.
Okay. Oh, if I'm about to critique Star Wars in this podcast, I will. I'm trying to be like as amicable as possible, but now that I know that you have the same opinion I do.
Yeah, no, it was painful. It was painful.
Rough. It really is a textbook example of how not to do sequels. And I say that as somebody who understands writing is a difficult thing. I can't even imagine how hard writing for a multi-billion dollar franchise is, but I can tell you that they didn't do it the right way.
Although I think that the Star Wars sequel series is a sloppy example. Like, they didn't take something difficult and do their best with it. They took something difficult and didn't care about it.
Yeah,
I think a better example would be the Marvel Cinematic Universe after Endgame. Like, things across multiple series built to that. There's the Captain America series, Iron Man, and even Hulk, and these multiple series were building into this focal point. That culminated in Endgame. And then after that, like, where are you going to go from there?
Where do you
go? And still feel relevant.
Yeah. No, I would. I think that's a great example. The Marvel Cinematic Universe building to Endgame is one of the best examples, in my opinion, of the slow buildup that they knew they knew what they were doing and they did it well. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there were some duds pre-Endgame, but for the most part, they really had the gradual buildup. And if you look at each movie as its own chapter, each movie had its climax and the character changed. Climax, character change, climax, character change, all, but still building up to Endgame.
Yeah.
And you know, I know that there are some mixed feelings about Endgame. I loved it personally. You know, if other people didn't, I understand. But I thought they did that really well. And then afterward, they lost something really important, which was that they forgot that the emotional heart of each one of those movies really was the characters. Yeah, people stayed for the flashy effects and everything, but when are we allowed to spoil Endgame at this time? It's been like 1,000 years. I don't.
Sure. Yeah. So spoiler alert. Okay. Spoiling Endgame.
Yeah. So spoiling Endgame. If you haven't seen it, congratulations. You've lived under a rock. When Tony Stark dies, that's why it's so impactful. That guy, we have seen him go from this arms dealer who in the first movie got a bit better. He learned he didn't want to kill people anymore. He was still a very rough person by the end of that first movie, but he was definitely on his way. Still, by Civil War, he was still not the type of person to really sacrifice himself yet. He would put himself in danger, but he wasn't there. And then we see that character arc go all the way to the very opposite of what he used to be. Gradually, such a perfect buildup. And he killed himself, he didn't kill himself. He sacrificed himself for everybody. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of always using pop culture, like going right back to Marvel and Star Wars, but but people know
it's a reference point.
Yeah, it's a good reference point, and there's some really good examples of writing in those, and some bad ones if we talk about the sequels. But yeah, it shows the importance of character. And once Tony Stark died and Endgame kind of died, the only times I've really liked Marvel movies has been Spider-Man, because Spider-Man did not forget the emotional component of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the heart of why people are watching.
So coming off of Break the Moon, and you said you wanted to break into epic fantasy, how do you find yourself shifting about your methods or the way you look at your work to try to make that shift?
Yeah, so I haven't shifted very well yet. I'm still working on it. But the way I've found I've shifted is where it comes from science fiction, fantasy that's in near future. Again, you have that whole groundwork already laid about society, so you can build like secret societies alongside your characters really easily. You have so much more room to talk about your characters, have them interact, and their interactions are what build those secrets coming out. And Break the Moon, in some sense, is also a mystery novel. So every chapter has a new question answered and a new question raised. And each time a question is answered, things shift for the characters. Something is brought out that they don't know, and it affects them in their life, and you get to see their emotional reaction to that, and you get to see them slowly change for better or worse. When it comes to epic fantasy, I'm struggling to balance character with world building. And you want to mix the two. You know, you don't want to ever have a scene. I think it's said that in each scene, you need three things. You need to move the plot forward, you need to build the world around it, and you need to grow the character arc. Scene has to have all three of those things. And sometimes getting the characters to show different aspects of themselves while you're also trying to build the scene for the reader, or rather the world for the reader. It takes a lot of words, and better wordsmiths than me are doing it well, and I'm trying to learn from them. But I think that's my biggest struggling.
I think I would argue that you don't necessarily need to be building the world in every chapter or every scene, because there's a point where
the world is built enough and you can just move inside it. But yeah, if you're not moving the plot and building character, well, if you're not moving the plot, why is the scene in there? If you're telling something relevant about a character's development, even if you have a scene where hypothetically it's all inner dialogue and so no plot points are accomplished during that, in that scene, I would say that if there is relevant character development, that is moving the plot. It might be a small movement. Sometimes that happens, but yeah. So how did you say it? Like pushing the plot and building the world, or building the plot and building the character?
First off, I agree with everything you said. They say that the best scenes have all three, but you only need to have two. But I think your example with inner dialogue, building a character and that is moving the plot forward. Especially if the plot could not have moved forward if that character didn't, say, have that revelation or come to this conclusion that he or she needed to come to. So what I said was each scene, in my opinion, needs to move the plot forward, continue building the world in some sense. And this applies to science fiction too. And what did I say? Develop the character. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And have you consumed Brandon Sanderson? Read or listened to? Okay. So in the Mistborn archive, Mistborn, wow, all over the place. In the Stormlight archive, some fan I am. In the Stormlight archive, like the main character, I would say the way it's presented is Kaladin. Definitely in book one, it's mostly about Kaladin. But we have occasionally these interludes, and I want to get your take on what these interludes, like with Lyft. So, soft spoiler alert, we may reveal some surprises. I don't know. So like the scenes with Lyft, how would you interpret those as far as their function within the book?
I know of Stormlight Archives. I haven't read it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, is there another example? I don't know. Maybe did you read Jurassic Park?
The book?
Yeah.
Sorry, no.
Okay.
Have you read James Dashner?
No.
No. Okay.
All right. I'll tell.
Yeah. Go for it.
I don't think this has any spoilers in Stormlight Archive. The main character is Kaladin. They often call him Kaladin Stormblessed. I won't explain that because that will be spoilers. Only halfway through the book. You know, if you've read halfway through book one, that's already not a spoiler. But there's Kaladin, there's Shallan, there's Adolin, Adolin's dad. Anyway, their last name, Dalinar. No, that's his first name, Dalinar. So there are these characters, and each one has his or her own arc. And that's all appropriate. So like when we see a scene with Kaladin, or when we see a scene with Dalinar, what's happening there is building that character. What's happening there is building that different character, but it's all building the same plot. Mm-hmm. And then we have these interludes with a character named Lyft, and she's a young girl, and she is like off in some other part of the world, and she has a very distinct view on the world. And so her point of view reads very differently. And it, like Kaladin being the main character, at least in book one, when we jump over to Lyft, nothing is happening with Kaladin.
in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So at the surface level, you might say, well, that doesn't really push the plot forward. Maybe it doesn't right now. I could see the argument that, well, this is what I would say, is that it does ultimately, but we have to get to know her first. She does come into play, if I recall. My memory is bad here. But she does come into play in important things, important events later. So at first, like her little pranks or shenanigans, whatnot, are about developing her and us getting to know her, which has an impact on her and her power, because she has a power, which has an impact on the huge overarching plot of the series. It has its role to play. So it's interesting. Because at first glance, you might not think that it meets those requirements, but if you think about it, it does. It's just a slower burn.
Yeah. Have you heard of Chekhov's gun?
I've heard of it. I don't remember what it is.
Yeah. So the idea is with Chekhov's gun is if you show a gun in a scene, like say a gun is placed atop the mantle of a fireplace when someone walks in, it's just talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
At some point, that gun has to be fired. Now that's Chekhov's gun in a nutshell. Now that's a kind of simplified version because the idea is more that the gun just has to have a use at some point, because mm-hmm. if you draw attention to it as the writer, you can't just throw it away.
Yeah.
You could use it as a red herring, but that's less
likely. I saw a meme that said, how to sound ominous and suspicious. And it was like being oddly specific or unnecessarily specific. And it's like, they arrived in front of his still unburnt house.
Like, yep. that's actually...
Why are you telling us it's unburnt? That's because it's going to get burned later. Mm-hmm. Unless you're just being ominous for no reason. People are going to get frustrated with that.
That's exactly right. And when it comes to Brandon Sanderson, you know that he's not going to write something that isn't going to be used somewhere down the line in a mm-hmm. cool twist. And that's kind of... I know we were talking a little bit earlier about twists, and that's something that I really enjoy writing, are twists that make it so that if you go back and reread the book, you will read almost everything in a different light than you currently read it the first time.
Uh-huh. And in which book specifically? It's called Break the Moon. Can you show us that
in
that cover again? Moon. All right.
Reverse it. But yeah. So every chapter I try to write at least a little bit of a twist, and then there's the huge twist at the end, and I not like M. Night Shyamalan twist, he's a mm-hmm. bit over the top, but I like that recontextualizes everything that you read before, so that if you do read it again, you see people saying certain things, you see people acting certain ways, you think, oh, that's why they did that, you know, because the trick is trying to make it so that the first time they read it, they think one thing, mm-hmm. and it still makes sense to them. Like, oh, okay, this character reacted this way. That makes sense in context. But then when you read the whole story and come back to it, you read, oh, the character reacted this way. That makes even more sense with more context. So because if you're trying to set that up, one thing to avoid is writing with the intention of it only making sense on second read through. You don't want that. Like you said, that'd just be frustrating. And that's, I do struggle a little bit when it comes to an author setting something up way in advance, like the lift scenes. You know, I haven't read them, but if I'm reading a lot of those and nothing's happening for a long stretch of time, I'm going to start skipping them.
Oh yeah. No, I think these scenes with lift have a different function as well. They not only do step the grand arc forward, although maybe not at first glance.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they do move things along, they're an interlude. They are like, I've slogged through this stuff, and maybe you haven't slogged through it, but like you're trying to get through the book because you can't put it down. And then you come across this thing, it's kind of a refresher you know, splash cool water on your face because it's very different.
Yeah.
There's a different flavor to it.
And so, a good enough author like Brandon Sanderson, he can pull that off. A novice author like me, I would struggle a bit more. But and that's, I think, because if there was something like it ended on a cliffhanger, and then I got this unrelated scene, and then it like jumps to continuing the cliffhanger, I would just be like, I don't care what's happening here. I want to see the cliffhanger. But again, when you're an author as seasoned as Brandon Sanderson, you know what you're doing, and you can make the pacing so that people won't skip it.
Well, and as newer authors, we learn that readers need it more obvious than we would think.
Hmm.
Like, you can... Typically, like you put the clues in there, and you know that the clues are in there, and if you have the context in mind, you go through and you're like, it's right, it's there, it's spelled out. But you have somebody else read it for the first time, and they're like, what is this? I don't know what to do with this information. I don't know what this means. So yeah, a lot of the time, you have to be less sneaky than you think you would need to be.
Yeah, it's such a balancing act. I've been on both sides of this where I'll write something and my editor will be like, I have no clue what you're talking about. And then I'll write something and my editor says, why are you beating me over the head with this? I get it. Stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there really is that fine line that you gotta walk.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess we're kind of, here's a lull, and we've had a good conversation. It's a good amount of time, so we'll probably wrap that up there. Now, where can listeners find your book online?
Yes, so I'm going to put it in front of the camera one last time. I really like seeing it. It's the cover backwards. Break the Moon, you can find it on Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Nobles, online retailers. If you read it, please leave a review. Even if it's just a star review, yes. It really helps.
Yes. Do leave reviews.
Yeah, please.
So I see, Mike, I see that you have 7 ratings on Amazon. My book has 3. It's so painful. Like,
yeah,
I need some more reviews so that other people can find it and know like, oh, you know, this 4.6 or this 4.7 rating, it actually means something. It's not like 3 people just so happened to like it, you know?
And that's tough. So
we both have good ratings, but we have few of them. We need more. So,
yeah, so
listeners out there, if you love us, encourage others as well to review their books or at least rate them. Yeah, do a star rating.
Yeah.
Because it helps other people find them and enjoy them.
Yep. And so, I've talked to my agent and she says like the number one way that people find books is through the rating system. Goodreads and Amazon. Those are the 2 number one. Please rate Nightshade Unicorn and Break the Moon on Goodreads and Amazon. We will appreciate it.
Yeah. And I have, again, few reviews on Goodreads as well. I have 2 ratings on Goodreads.
It's tough.
But you know, they'll come. And I'm trying to do a few promotions. They're scheduled, but it just comes so slowly.
It's hard not to be impatient.
Yeah, hopefully book 2 will speed things along a little bit.
I'm sure,
and I might have bitten off more than I can chew with book 2, because in book 1, where's this page in the back? It says, oh, come on. Oh, by the way, I found a typo today.
Oh, no.
Found a typo like an hour and a half ago. There's a very minor character, and in the pronunciation guide, the character's name is Aulbwin, A-U-L-B-W-I-N, and the pronunciation guide, I left out the U.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I'll have to fix that when I get a chance. But in the back of book 1, I promised book 2, and I give myself a deadline.
Oh,
okay. August 28th.
You got to stick to that then.
Yeah. Although I am behind schedule, so it might only be ebook on that day.
Yeah.
Hopefully not. Hopefully I'll have print as well. We'll see.
That burst of creativity will come in and it'll start going real quick. Just on the last topic of typos, during the first, I have the pre-sale cover version on here, uh-huh. and my editor is listed as my mother in the acknowledgments. So they fixed it because, immediately. Uh-huh. But it's just one of those things where typos do get through on the first draft. Not first draft, but first print. It's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for your time. Stay on after we stop the recording. Just for the record, we're recording this on May 13th, 2024. Mm-hmm. I anticipate the episode will probably come out late this month. It could be into June. I'm not sure, but thank you, Mike Buxbaum, and listeners, go check out his book.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.